tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. An arrest warrant has been issued for a foreign man wanted in the bombing that killed at least 22 people Monday at a Bangkok shrine. The Thai National Police Chief said Wednesday the suspected bomber was likely acting as part of a network, but investigators have not yet established his motives or nationality. Authorities released a sketch of the suspect, a young man with black shaggy hair, stubble and round plastic-framed glasses. There is a $28,000 reward for information leading to his capture. A police spokesman later said two other men, one wearing red, another wearing white in the CCTV video, are also suspects in the attacks. Monks led prayers and residents left flowers and other tributes at the open-air Hindu shrine, which officially reopened to the public on Wednesday. Islamic State militants in Syria have beheaded the former director of antiquities in Palmyra, the ancient city noted worldwide for its archaeological treasures, which the extremists seized 3 months ago. Palmyra's current director of antiquities, Mamoun Abdul Karim, said his 82-year-old predecessor, Khalid Assad, was killed on Tuesday. He had worked for 50 years on preserving the city's 2,000-year-old ruins, which are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Human Rights Watch leveled harsh criticism Wednesday at Egypt's new anti-terrorism law, saying the measure has an overly broad definition of what constitutes a terrorist act and leaves Egyptians open to stiff sentences for things that may amount to civil disobedience. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi signed the law into effect on Sunday. This is VOA News. With the Arab League again calling for a new strategy to fight the Islamic State group in Libya, analysts say the need for action has never been more urgent. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo.
Libyan Foreign Minister Mohamed al-Dairi has called on the Arab League for air support and weapons to fight the so-called Islamic State militants who are increasingly operating in Libya. Egyptian Arab League representative Tariq Adel cites the U.S.-led coalition in Syria and Iraq, saying inaction in Libya amounts to a double standard. Libyan officials say militant attacks have been terrorizing the country since 2012. Recently, ISIS reportedly crushed an uprising in Sirte by killing dozens of people and desecrating bodies. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Russia sentenced an Estonian security officer to 15 years in prison for spying. The lawyer for Eston Kovar told reporters a regional court in the western Russian city of Pskov handed down the ruling Wednesday. Estonia said Kovar was kidnapped by unknown gunmen and taken forcibly across the Russian border. Estonian officials said Kovar was investigating a smuggling operation involving Russian intelligence agents. Estonia called for his release, as did the European Union. Stocks in China fluctuated wildly but ended with slight gains Wednesday as investors nervously wondered if the government will continue its efforts to prop up the market. Shanghai fell as much as 5% in morning trading before recovering to end the day up 1.61%. Shanghai shares fell over 6% on Tuesday. It was the biggest single-day drop since late July when a massive sell-off prompted Beijing to artificially support the market. The African Growth and Opportunities Act is much more than a simple trade agreement, top U.S. officials said this week, as they prepare to meet later this month in Gabon for a summit on the U.S.-Africa agreement. AGOA was recently renewed for 10 years by the U.S. Congress. The act, which was originally signed in 2000, provides 39 sub-Saharan African nations with liberal access to the U.S. market. The well-connected owners of a warehouse that exploded in the northeastern Chinese port city of Tianjin last week used their relationships with officials to obtain apparently fraudulent safety licenses, according to state media. The corruption allegation, which surfaced Wednesday, is likely to prompt further outrage over the explosion, which killed 114 people and injured hundreds more. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In commemoration of World Humanitarian Day, international agencies are paying tribute to the thousands of humanitarian workers who have lost their lives or been injured in the line of duty.
That's reporter Lisa Schlein in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, the International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. And the International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more on a ruling today by appeals judges at the Hague-based court.
Thank you, Madam President. The situation in the Republic of Kenya in the case of the prosecutor versus Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta.
The appeals decision refers to whether Kenya obstructed evidence that International Criminal Court prosecutors say they needed to build their case against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Presiding Judge Sylvia Fernandez read the decision that concludes trial judges made mistakes.
The appeals chamber finds that the trial chamber erred in the exercise of its discretion by conflating the non-compliance proceedings against Kenya with the criminal proceedings against Mr. Kenyatta, by failing to address whether judicial measures had been exhausted, and by assessing the sufficiency of evidence and the conduct of the prosecutor in an inconsistent manner.
President Kenyatta had been charged as an indirect co-perpetrator in violence following Kenya's 2007 election, but last December, ICC prosecutors dropped charges of crimes against humanity against him, accusing the Kenyan government of blocking their investigations. Mr. Kenyatta has maintained his innocence, and the government said it complied with prosecution demands. Judge Fernandez ordered the lower court to reconsider its decision not to report Kenya to the ICC's governing body for noncompliance. In Nairobi, Amnesty International's East Africa campaigner, Victor Odero, reacted cautiously, saying the rights group is waiting for the trial court's reconsideration of its ruling.
Amnesty International's position, of course, is that states have to respect and abide by the obligations under international human rights law. And this is, in fact, the matter that is to be determined, whether or not Kenya, in the first instance, abided by its obligations under the statute.
The ICC has made non-compliance referrals to the governing body before, including on cases dealing with Sudan, Chad, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. That body can then impose sanctions, but so far has not done so. Kenya's deputy president, William Ruto, is still on trial at the ICC on charges similar to those against Mr. Kenyatta. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis. ICG Director Thierry Vercoulon says continuing retaliation between armed groups could lead to greater division within the nation's defense and security forces. The military has largely been disengaged from the recent violence, but Vercoulon says ethnic tension within the army may be resurfacing. His comments were made in an interview published online by Bujumbura Radio Bonisha after the assassinations of Colonel Jean Bikomagu, the former chief of defense staff, and Lieutenant General Adolphe Inshamiramina, the former head of intelligence. He says it's obvious those assassinations are acts of retaliation from one camp against the other, and that the country is slipping towards conflict. Burundi has been rocked by violence since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced in April he would seek another term. He denied he was seeking a third term because he was initially elected by parliament and not voters.
In related news, the new president of SADC, the Southern Africa Development Community, says he's against African leaders staying in power too long. Botswana President Ian Khama succeeds Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe as SADC chairman. He says, in his opinion, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza has served two terms. Khama says that at the end of the day, once you sit in the office and assume all the functions of that office, you are serving your term. Also, a coalition of Burundi opposition groups have urged the president to resign by August 26th to prevent further violence. The call comes from the National Council for the Respect of the Arusha Agreement for Peace and Reconciliation in Burundi and the restoration of the rule of law.
In commemoration of World Humanitarian Day, international agencies are paying tribute to the thousands of humanitarian workers who have lost their lives or been injured in the line of duty. Lisa Schlein reports from UN European Headquarters in Geneva.
In December 2008, the UN General Assembly established World Humanitarian Day on August 19th in memory of the terrorist attack on UN headquarters in the Iraqi capital Baghdad in 2003. 22 UN staff members were killed, including Mission Chief Sergio Vieira de Mello. UN Chief Spokesman in Geneva, Ahmed Fawzi, was de Mello's press secretary. That day is seared in his memory.
It was the beginning of a downward spiral in terms of UN protection and UN humanitarian work, where we realized that we had become a target of terrorism.
Since then, attacks against humanitarian workers responding to emergencies have increased and become all too commonplace. The World Health Organization is launching a campaign to draw attention to continued attacks on healthcare workers and health facilities. WHO reports 603 healthcare workers were killed and 958 injured in direct attacks in 32 countries in 2014 alone. Rudy Connix is coordinator of WHO's Department of Emergency Risk Management and Humanitarian Response. He says healthcare workers and facilities are under regular and constant attack in areas of conflict.
Just recently, in Yemen, for example, 30 hospitals have been attacked. 14 healthcare workers have been injured. 5 of them have been killed. But it's not only in Yemen. In Syria, in Iraq, in Central African Republic, in Ukraine, in South Sudan today, hospitals are attacked and healthcare workers risk their lives to do what healthcare workers do, provide services, provide health to people. These attacks must stop.
But it is not only in areas of conflict where the lives of healthcare workers are at risk. WHO notes in West Africa, more than half of the 875 health workers infected with Ebola have died. Health workers were among several people killed by villagers in Guinea while trying to raise awareness about this deadly disease. The number of polio cases globally has been reduced by 99%, but this achievement has come at a great cost. WHO reports more than 100 health workers have been attacked trying to eradicate polio. 32 have been killed in Pakistan while trying to provide vaccines to young children at risk of contracting this crippling disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Arab League urges member states to come to the military aid of Libya's Tobruk regime. It's fighting against extremists who are fighting in eastern Libya as affiliates of the Islamic State. The League fell short of a full commitment to Libya in the emergency summit yesterday. However, they agreed to meet next week to discuss the formation of a joint Arab force to intervene in regional crises and combat terrorism. Libyan Foreign Minister Mohamed Al-Dari told League diplomats that Libya is bleeding. He warned that his ill-equipped government is not able to fight off the Islamic State. Al-Dari says the extremists are seeking to establish a base in Libya as the U.S.-led airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Libya has slipped into political division and militant chaos since the 2011 NATO-backed uprising that ended the rule of Muammar Gaddafi. Libya has been under a UN arms embargo since then. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. And the International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
It's estimated there are 22 million unsafe abortions every year, resulting in 22,000 deaths. A new study looks at the global cost of unsafe abortions, including the many women who are treated for complications of botched procedures. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Guttmacher Institute says unsafe abortion accounts for up to 15% of maternal deaths every year. What's more, 7 million women annually are treated at medical facilities after complications set in. The Institute is a nonprofit organization that says it aims to advance sexual and reproductive health and rights through research, policy analysis, and public education. Its study is based on health statistics and scientific studies from 26 developing countries. Dr. Sushila Singh is the lead author of the study, published in BJOG, an international journal of obstetrics and gynecology. She describes how the procedure can be unsafe.
That means that the woman either went to a provider who is not trained to provide this service, not formally trained, doesn't have the right skills, or she goes to a place that is unhygienic. So there is a risk of infection, even if the person is trained.
She says unsafe abortions can be performed by a variety of people in different settings.
It could be a midwife, informal midwife, a trained birth attendant at the lower end of the qualification scale. And it could even be a nurse, a trained nurse, or an MD, but they may not have the training to do the abortion, or they're doing it under conditions that aren't very hygienic.
Dr. Singh says the report's findings provide further evidence about the number of women who suffer injury as a result of complications due to unsafe abortion, often leading to chronic disability.
Extreme hemorrhage, a lot of bleeding, up to a perforation of a uterus or an infection that leads to a high-grade fever, sepsis even, lacerations, and depending on if a woman inserts an object into her vagina. There are different categories of complications from the less severe up to the most severe and life-threatening.
The study says the annual cost of treating women for complications of unsafe abortions is $232 million. But that's just for those who actually go for treatment. The study estimates the cost for treating all the women who actually need it would be more than $560 million.
The quality of the care for the $232 million is what are they getting right now, which is not as WHO recommends such care should be. We all know that the quality of care varies a lot across the world. Perhaps it's not that the country or the government or the provider doesn't want to give good quality care, but they may not have the training or the facilities, the capacity to do it.
The findings, she says, show the importance of prevention for women.
Better contraceptive counseling and services, a better range of choice of methods, follow-up of women if they have a problem with a method to offer them something else. This set of services at a good quality would help women to prevent the unintended pregnancy in the first place, which would avoid having to resort to an abortion.
Dr. Singh says good quality medical care is a must for women suffering complications from unsafe abortions. Delaying treatment could mean death.
The fact is that safe abortion services, the availability and accessibility of these, would prevent the situation also.
The Guttmacher Institute study says the highest rate for treatment for unsafe abortion is in Pakistan. The lowest is in Brazil. Regionally, the highest rate is in Asia, primarily South Central Asia, followed by Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Dr. Singh says debate and controversy over abortion is widespread, in part because of the stigma often associated with the procedure. But she says many women will seek an abortion out of desperation over an unintended pregnancy, even though there are laws banning or restricting it. She says reproductive rights can be subject to the political climate within a country. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The final report has been released evaluating progress made in reaching the Millennium Development Goals for reducing maternal deaths. The MDGs, which were backed by the UN and end this year, aimed to reduce maternal mortality by three quarters. The study says many countries have reduced deaths by half. However, the Global Women's Health Organization and Gender Health says efforts must continue to limit reproductive injuries that put mothers at risk, such as obstetric fistula. They say the condition ruins a woman's chances of having a livelihood, raising a healthy family, and contributing to her community. And it argues that ending fistula means eradicating obstructed labor. The still high numbers of women with obstetric fistula signify that much work needs to be done in addressing maternal health care. Dr. Lori Romanzi is project director for Fistula Care Plus, a project of Engender Health. She says obstetric fistula is part of a long list of problems suffered by women and their newborns as a result of obstructed labor. Fistula is a hole that develops between the vagina and the rectum or bladder. As a result, affected women secrete urine and feces.
The relationship between fistula and maternal mortality is simply that obstructed labor often kills women. But if it does not kill the woman, then she will have any number of morbidities, only one of which is obstetric fistula. She can also have severe internal scarring that makes sexual relations impossible. She can have infertility, nerve damage that makes it impossible for her to walk properly. Then there is all the psychological sequelae. A lot of them have what is, in essence, a post-traumatic stress disorder. They're mourning very often the loss of a stillborn baby. They have anxiety, depression, difficulty concentrating, and this can persist even after they have been treated for the fistula condition and successfully so.
Dr. Romanzi emphasized that fistula ruins a woman's life because she is often ostracized by the community or her family for odorous leakages of bodily waste.
Here in the U.S., incontinence is either the number one or number two reason to admit someone to nursing home. There's no human community anywhere in the world that finds living with a constantly incontinent person to be something that's easily tolerated. In poor countries, women who have become constantly incontinent as a result of fistula don't have the option to be warehoused into a community, so they're often simply ostracized by their community. About 40 to 50% of them are divorced. What I find remarkable about that statistic is that we've got about half of the husbands not divorcing their wives, and I think those men deserve to be acknowledged and applauded for continuing to support the mother of their children.
Dr. Romanzi identified two groups of women who develop fistula in terms of obstetric indicators. The largest of the two groups are mature women who have given birth four or five times and for whatever reason are now having problems during childbirth. Often the baby is stuck.
There are many reasons for this. She could have some untreated, undiagnosed gestational diabetes, making the baby quite large. She might have a twin pregnancy this time. That's more common as women get older. Also, newborn weight tends to simply be a little bit larger with each subsequent pregnancy. As women get past the mark of having had five babies, the babies are also more prone to be in a strange position, what's called transverse lie, where the baby is sideways. This can lead to obstructed labor.
The other group of women includes those who develop fistula with their first baby, even though the young mother may have waited until her late teens or early 20s to have children.
There is this, what I call the poster child of fistula, is the 12-year-old child bride who gets pregnant before she has her first menses and has an obstructed labor while she's still a small child, possibly of stunted growth due to poor nutrition. And while that's true, that group, which gets all the attention in the lay press, is actually a very small component of the total group of women who actually survive obstructed labor and come in with a fistula.
The main message Dr. Romanzi takes from the experiences of afflicted women is that ending fistula means ending obstructed labor. Equally important, she says, is there is no safe way to give birth without having a skilled birth attendant, such as a midwife or doctor, or being at a proper medical center.
This is something that's missing from a lot of literature you read in the public. People want to feel very sorry for these poor women and all the tragedy they face, and they want to act like it's something that happens over there, when in actuality, obstructed labor happens every day, everywhere. In high-income countries, it is a significant contributor to our cesarean section rate.
And Gender Health has been working for decades to improve reproductive health systems for both women and men. Dr. Romanzi says access to reliable contraception is the key to reducing the risk of fistula.
And Gender Health, which was originally founded some decades ago, with the sole purpose of improving access to family planning and birth control methods. As it expanded globally, this remained a core component of the activity. And wherever we are working with women suffering fistula and fistula programs, we are also working to make sure that the delivery mechanism is executed to a global standard.
And Gender Health has offered gender equity improvement programs that include men as partners. These programs help men understand what women go through when they are in labor. They also help them recognize danger signs so mothers at risk can get medical care as soon as possible, despite some traditional and cultural beliefs that women should have their babies at home. I'm Kim Lewis, reporting from Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bungani right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa.
Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete's second five-year term is nearly over. On October 25th, the nation's voters head to the polls to choose a leader. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests for an in-depth discussion on the Tanzanian elections and the role of the opposition in the upcoming vote. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The International Criminal Court will re-examine whether Kenya failed to cooperate in a case of crimes against humanity, of crimes against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, and the International Crisis Group says Burundi must submit to international mediation to avoid an ethnic crisis. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, the third part of our series on Eritrean migrants. I'm Kim Lewis with Nihayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning your sports report with big news from the world of athletics.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to two-time Olympic champion Sebastian Coe of Britain, who on Wednesday was elected president of the International Association of Athletics Federations.
Very, very flattered today. Very, very honored. I haven't really had much of a chance to allow it to sink in, and I guess that's probably not going to happen for a day or two. But I joined an athletics club when I was 11. I had a 10, 12-year apprenticeship before I got to an Olympic stadium. I've had the joys of Olympic competition. I've had the joys of being a part of a team that created something very special in London a few years ago, but this for me is the pinnacle. It is my sport, it's my passion, it's the thing that I've always wanted to do.
Sebastian Coe defeated another Olympic champion, Sergei Bubka from Ukraine, 115-92, in voting by the IAAF's member federations in Beijing, China. The balloting took place 3 days before the opening of the World Championships in Athletics in the Chinese capital. The 58-year-old Ko pledged to make track and field an even stronger sport.
Track and field is the number one sport, and I'm absolutely delighted to be the president of the number one sport, and I will do everything within my human capabilities to make sure that our sport maintains the values, maintains the strong legacies, and the very, very firm foundations that President Diak has left me with.
Sebastian Coe will officially succeed Senegal's Lamine Diak as the IAAF president on August 31st after the end of the World Championships in Beijing. The 82-year-old Diak, who was a long jumper in his younger days, was first elected the IAAF president in 1999. In Beijing on Wednesday, Sebastian Coe paid tribute to the athletics chief.
I'm sitting next to a man who has dedicated his life to the sport, and I know in private conversations wants to spend a great deal more time with his many grandchildren. I'm not letting him go too far. He ceases to be our president on the 31st of August, but he will always be our spiritual president, and he will certainly be my spiritual president. So thank you, Lamine, for your help, your generosity of time, your guidance, and above all, your friendship. That is something that I will always treasure.
That's Sebastian Coe praising the outgoing IAAF president, Lamine Diak. Coe was elected the next president of the International Association of Athletics Federations on Wednesday in Beijing.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Thanks, Shaka. My Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you Wednesday night at 18:30 UTC with another edition of his Straight Talk Africa program. Two big Japanese companies are offering some big bonus money for athletes who set world records at the upcoming World Championships in Beijing. Marco Uma reports.
Any athlete who sets a world record at the IAAF World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China, stands to earn US$100,000 bonus besides their normal prize money, the World Athletics governing body IAAF revealed in Beijing. The World Athletics Championships, which is the third biggest and most prestigious global sports event after the Summer Olympics and FIFA World Cup, starts on Saturday and runs until the 30th of August. Japanese Communications Corporation, TDK, is sponsoring the men's world record bonus prize, while Japan's Toyota Motor Corporation is sponsoring the women's world record bonus prize. The IAAF stressed that prize money and bonuses will only be disbursed after the athletes' performance are ratified, which also includes clearing the relevant anti-doping procedures.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
Abdul Ngala checked out my Facebook page. Abdul lives in Bamenda, Cameroon, and he commented on a post dealing with Sebastian Coe's victory in the IAAF presidential election. Abdul writes, and I quote, "I knew you were going to make it during your campaign tour in Cameroon. Congrats and bravo, Mr. Coe. I hope you will make things happen, as I am your supporter." Some news now about a big basketball player from Cameroon who has had some bad injury luck since launching his professional career in the NBA. Philadelphia 76ers center Joel Embiid is recovering after undergoing surgery for the second time on his right foot, this time a bone graft procedure. The 21-year-old Embiid is from Yaoundé, Cameroon. During the foot surgery, he had two existing screws replaced and a bone graft was done using bone from his hip. The 2.13 meters tall Embiid was the third overall pick in the 2014 National Basketball Association draft, but he missed his rookie season in the NBA because of a stress fracture in his foot. And he's been hobbled ever since. We wish Joel Embiid a quick recovery. I want to see him out on the courts for the Philadelphia 76ers. Now let's go to Tunisia, where the 16-team African Men's Basketball Championship tipped off on Wednesday. Egypt trounced Gabon 96-49 in the tournament's opening game. Egyptian guard Ibrahim El Gamal scored a game-high 14 points. In Wednesday's second game, Nigeria defeated Central African Republic 88-63. The competition will culminate August 30th when the final will be played, and the winner of that game will represent Africa at next year's Olympic men's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Turning to tennis, Africa's highest-ranked men's player, Kevin Anderson of South Africa, is off to a good start at the Cincinnati Masters Tournament here in the United States. The tall Anderson defeated Argentina's Leonardo Meyer in three sets in his opening match. The final score from Cincinnati, 7-6, 3-6, and 6-1. Reporter Catherine Whitaker caught up with Anderson after the match and asked him about his victory.
Yeah, very pleased. I stumbled at the first round the last few weeks. So it definitely feels good to get through that. You're always trying to come out here and forget anything in the past, just really focus on the match. I felt I did that well in the first set. Obviously, it was important in the tiebreak. I didn't get off to the start I wanted to, saving a couple break points, and then him getting the break, I felt he was serving well. I wasn't putting enough returns in the play. Gave myself a slight opportunity in the end of the second, but came out and played a very good third set.
I know it's been a tough few weeks for you. First round loss in Montreal last week. How keen are you to have a good week this week? Are you putting pressure on yourself to have a good week?
Well, I think there's a balance there. I mean, of course, I want to do well. But at the same time, I feel, putting that extra pressure on doesn't do you any favours. I mean, it's still a brand new week. You come up against tough players. Whoever I'm playing against obviously wants to win as well. So I think it's, important when you've had a couple weeks that haven't gone your way to really, try to forget about it. It's a long year, The goal is to approach this tournament like I've done really well the last couple of weeks, just have that same feeling of confidence. I feel like I'm hitting the ball really well, especially all the stuff we've been working on the practice courts and stuff. It's just about getting out of the match court and executing it, and, I felt I did well today.
Jack's up next. How are you going to deal with having the crowd against you in that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be a good match. The crowd's a bit of a non-factor for me. I feel like I enjoy playing in front of people, and especially crowds that get into it. That's nothing that's ever really affected me before. It's just that same old story. It's really about me going out there, taking one point at a time, playing my game. As I said, it's going to be, he's a really good player, and I'm going to have to play well to get through.
That's South African tennis star Kevin Anderson. And Kevin was talking with reporter Catherine Whitaker in Cincinnati, Ohio, at the Cincinnati Masters Tournament. The Cincinnati event is a warm-up competition for the U.S. Open, one of the year's biggest tournaments. In fact, the last Grand Slam tournament of the year, which will be played in New York City. If we take a look at the ATP Tour rankings, Kevin Anderson is currently the 15th ranked men's player in the world. That makes him the highest ranked African player in the men's ATP rankings. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Twitter. My handle is @VOASunnySports. I enjoy getting those tweets from our listeners in Africa. Got one recently from Dr. Larry Zamojay, from my friends at Brilla FM in Nigeria. Dr. Larry, the CEO of Brilla. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a third part of our series on Eritrean migrants. And next, we look into a program offering shelter to writers and artists at risk. But first, some music. Here is Kobe Maxwell of Ghana with Aruba.
Oh,
with 21st century. Session I am out of car. Jinan Chai Ati. So a friend with sister. Son with you Ati. So a friend with auntie. Son with you Ati. Grandma, who lady pancake. Son with you Ati. Go feel go die.
Maxwell of Ghana with Auraba.
Well, for many years, Europe has given asylum to refugees from Eritrea. It has acquired a reputation as a totalitarian and isolated state, a hermit nation on the Horn of Africa. The United Nations recently heaped more accusations of human rights violations on the government of President Isaias Afwerki. Despite those recent charges, a few European countries may be rethinking blanket amnesties for Eritrean refugees. Well, is change coming? The political advisor to Mr. Isaias is Yamani Gebrayab, an official who predicts change in Europe and in Eritrea. For this third report on Eritrean migrants, Yamani spoke from Asmara with VOA's David Arnold in Washington.
There may be several reasons why EU immigration officials are reassessing blanket asylum approvals for Eritreans. They may want to stop or reduce further Eritrean entries and to stop other migrants who falsely claim Eritrean nationality to receive asylum. Or EU officials may think Eritrea is shedding some of its domestic policies, policies that they believe led to human rights abuse. The UN Refugee Agency said youth conscription intensified last year, but Yamani says the EU is sending officials to Eritrea to see if their justification for that asylum policy is based on facts on the ground.
Several European countries from their migration and departments to come and look at the situation for themselves in Eritrea. The British have been here, the Danes have been here, the Norwegians have been here several times, the Dutch have been here, the Swedes are here right now, and people from Switzerland have been here. So key European countries have sent their people to look at the situation on the ground. And I think that they've come to the realization that what is being said about Eritrea is not true, that there is no political persecution in this country, that national service is not indefinite, that it does not constitute slave labor. They believe that Eritreans, those who travel to Europe, are traveling there essentially for economic reasons.
Economic refugees from other African countries lie about their nationality to get fast-track approval of asylum. Yamani says many Ethiopian migrants falsely claim Eritrean citizenship to gain that automatic asylum. But the Ethiopian government has its own refugee problems to solve. Security officials in Addis Ababa have arrested 200 Ethiopians on charges of smuggling. They asked the International Criminal Police Organization, or Interpol, to help extradite 80 more for prosecution in Ethiopian courts. Yamani says some migrants bound for European asylum are imposters.
People in this neighborhood, Ethiopians, Sudanese, Somalis, others, have claimed that they are Eritreans in order to expedite their asylum procedures. As far as minors is concerned, the same thing goes. You look at Ethiopia. Ethiopia is now at the heart of the human trafficking network. There are a lot of people from northern Ethiopia, minors, who are going to Europe posing as Eritreans.
The Eritrean government's view of its own recent history is that of a small country forced to become a war economy during a two-year border war with Ethiopia. The war cost as many as 100,000 lives and justified national service for anyone 18 or older. In Eritrea, refugees report that national service lasted for many years and became the instrument of punishment for critics of the state. Some have also charged that those who serve their country become forced labor in Eritrean gold mines operated by foreign firms. Yamani says current government policy requires that the 17 mining companies operating in Eritrea cannot hire an Eritrean unless he or she has a document proving they've been released from national service. Besides, Yamani says, national service is not just a standing army.
National service doesn't mean only people serving in the military. It means people serving mainly in the civilian sectors. So if you go to our schools, our teachers, probably around 60% are national service members. So they fulfill their national service obligations in our educational system, teaching. If you go to our health system, to our hospitals and clinics and health centers, again, a significant percentage of the people serving there are national service members. If you look into our agriculture, the people providing extension services to farmers and giving them advice are national service people.
An African affairs researcher who recently traveled to Asmara spoke with Mr. Isaias and others in the Asmara government. She described a charm offensive of officials looking to rid themselves of their old image. Yamani says post-war Eritrea will be different.
War entails certain restrictions on the society and the economy because you have just defense takes the priority at that particular time. Now that phase is coming to an end. We are to a new phase of growth. We believe that in the next 3 to 5 years, the Eritrean economy will see significant transformation. We believe that in 3 to 5 years, we'll be able to provide abundant opportunities for our young people. We're getting more and more confident about the development prospects in Eritrea. And that is leading to this change.
For the sake of economic development, the Eritrean government now considers whether to give up its war economy and the longtime practice of jailing its dissenters and its journalists. Meanwhile, the leaders of the European Union struggle with the summer's massive flow of migrants, and they now struggle with whether to welcome future Eritrean migrants who claim political asylum. This is David Arnold for VOA in Washington, D.C.
One day in January of 2014, award-winning Nigerian writer and gay rights activist Joda Dibia woke up gasping for air. Nigeria had just passed a law criminalizing homosexuality. The new law prompted Dibia to make the decision to leave his home country. Katarina Hoya spoke to Dibia in Sweden. He's a guest writer there at the Malmo City of Refuge, a program offering shelter to writers and artists at risk.
Dibia was happy earlier this year after the U.S. took a huge step of legalizing same-sex marriage. He immediately went online to read what Nigerians and other Africans were saying about the law.
Most of it was a fear of this coming to the continent. It almost kind of intensified the hatred people had for gay people as well.
Dibia was discouraged, but not surprised.
It's telling. It's happening just now. Africa is still kind of struggling to come to terms with the whole concept that gay people do exist in our society.
Nigeria has outlawed gay marriage, public displays of same-sex relations, and belonging to gay groups. The bill that also made it illegal to support gay rights sparked international condemnation.
Before, there wasn't a law. There was just a huge dislike against people who were different. Now, with a law saying that these people should be imprisoned, that changed a lot. You know, it empowered mob actions. It empowered people to interpret the law the way they want to and attack LGBTI people in the society.
Udibia was bewildered as he watched usually vocal LGBTI rights activists go quiet, fearing the law would be used against them.
People were hiding, people were running. People didn't know what to, you know, to make of the law itself and how it was going to be used against them. So, yeah, you know, there was that change, there was that fear, so to speak.
Dibia felt like he and many others who spoke on equal rights for LGBTI people were being silenced.
You know, I felt stifled. I felt like somebody had a pillow against my face and was choking me, you know, to death. That's how I felt, to wake up to that kind of news. And as a writer, I felt I wouldn't be able to talk on certain issues that I'm very passionate about. I wouldn't be able to be myself completely.
Udibia grew up in Lagos, Nigeria's financial powerhouse in the south. In 2005, he published his first novel, Walking with Shadows. It centers on Adrian, a successful Lagos executive who is exposed as gay by a former employee.
Walking with Shadows basically came up because I couldn't find any literature that spoke about LGBTI people within our country, the context of Africa. And so, yes, I told the story of a man who was closeted, who was married, which is always the case, who had a wife, kid, lovely career, law-abiding, and all of a sudden his world is shattered because he's exposed as a gay person.
His greatest sales figures for the book still come from Nigeria. To change the overall attitude towards LGBTI people in his home country, however, will take time, Dibia says. When the US Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage, it had a negative effect at first. Change in Nigeria needs to come from within, from people who dare to speak up, like Dibia. Katrina Höje for VOA News, Malmö.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The president of Guinea-Bissau, José Mário Vaz, has fired the prime minister and dismissed the government following escalating disagreements with Prime Minister Domingos Chimos Pereira. The rift threatens the stability seen there since the free and fair elections of 2014. The United States is carefully watching the political situation in Guinea-Bissau. We call on leaders to seek dialogue and consensus in resolving this crisis in a manner that serves the best interests of the Bissau-Guinean people. We commend the calm reaction of all parties and call on security forces, civil society, and political leaders to continue to act peacefully and in accordance with the Constitution and the rule of law. Managing political disagreement is a natural part of democratic rule, and we encourage continued constructive dialogue between leaders. At the March 2015 Brussels International Conference for Guinea-Bissau, the President and Prime Minister presented a vision of political and economic development for the country that garnered the support of the international community. The best hope for further progress on this agenda is for leaders to quickly come together and recommit themselves to the stated objectives. The United States looks to Bissau-Guinean leaders to show the world they can work together with the international community to move forward with political and economic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete's second five-year term is nearly over. On October 25th, the nation's voters head to the polls to choose a leader. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests for an in-depth discussion on the Tanzanian elections and the role of the opposition in the upcoming vote. That's next time on VOA Africa.
From Washington,